From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now. Today, the family of Breonna Taylor is demanding that the Kentucky Attorney General release transcripts from the grand jury that indicted one officer involved in the shooting that led to her death.
Release the transcript! Release the transcript!
Former Louisville detective Brett Hankison was charged Wednesday with endangering the lives of Taylor's neighbors when he fired his gun into Taylor's apartment in March. No one will face charges directly for Taylor's death, and her family and their lawyer say they want the state to be transparent about the indictments.
Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher also spoke this morning, stressing his commitment to racial justice reform, but also issuing a warning.
I know that most protesters continue to be peaceful and lawful. I thank you for that. But I want to caution the peaceful protesters, if you're in a group where destructive and violent behavior is happening, you need to separate from that group or you will be subject to arrest.
Police arrested more than 20 people last night, including a prominent state lawmaker. Ryan Van Velzer of WFPL in Louisville joins us now. And Ryan, people still very disappointed in the grand jury's decision this week. What did you see when you were out with protesters last night?
Yeah, what started out as a march through downtown Louisville became almost like a siege as police surrounded a church that offered protesters sanctuary. See, Louisville's mayor had put in place a curfew at 9 p.m., but the order exempted houses of worship. So protesters crossed onto the property just as curfew began. And as he said, police arrested a couple dozen of the protesters who lagged behind. That was after some people smashed a window and threw a flare into the public library, I guess trying to set it on fire. I should stress that most of the protesters were peaceful and protest organizers had specifically requested people not participate in vandalism. Now, police said they declared an unlawful assembly because they saw several acts of property destruction. People went to the church as a safe place. After about 2 hours, police left and allowed protesters to disperse.
Among those arrested last night, State Representative Attica Scott was charged with a felony. And it's also, she's noteworthy. She's prominent because she's heading up a bill to ban no-knock warrants statewide. What can you tell us about that?
Right. As you said, police charged Representative Scott with first-degree rioting, as well as unlawful assembly and failure to disperse. She called the charges ridiculous at a press conference. She joined literally just after being released from jail.
And what's the reaction been to her arrest?
I should say that it's important to understand that Scott has been an outspoken critic of police throughout all of this. She's the state's only black female legislator, and she's actually already suing LMPD, Louisville Metro Police Department. She did that because earlier this year she was tear-gassed by police while receiving medical treatment during a protest. People are outraged. They're questioning if this was politically motivated. Tamika Mallory, that's Breonna Taylor's mom, she wants to know why white militia she saw out past curfew were treated differently than Representative Scott.
Okay, I think we have another clip of tape here from Chris Wells, another one of the protesters you spoke with last night. Let's listen.
It's painful. It's foul. But only way to change this is get out there and really vote. Get them out of office. Because these marches is useless if we don't go vote. Then if we don't go vote, that just means everything that we just work for and March 4, step together, locked up for, be useless if we don't go out there and go for it.
You can hear the weariness there in his voice. We've heard from Breonna Taylor's family. You mentioned what they're saying today. But what about the police? Obviously, this is a very stressful time for them. In fact, two of their officers, Louisville officers, were shot this week during protests. What are we hearing from them?
You know, last week, LMPD officers testified in front of Louisville's Metro Council. Assistant Police Chief Lieutenant Colonel Josh Judah called the protests a cataclysmic event for the city, and at one point said the city would be destroyed if officers had not intervened. You know, we saw that two officers get shot earlier this week. Interim Police Chief Robert Schroeder says he's very concerned about what he's seeing on the streets. At the same time, some of the rank-and-file officers have called protesters thugs and punks. One of those officers was just relieved of duty. Her last day is October 1st, and I should say that Interim Police Chief Robert Schroeder is set to retire at the end of the month. He'll be replaced by Yvette Gentry.
Right. Ryan Van Velzer of WFPL News in Louisville, Kentucky. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
President Trump is expected to announce his nominee for the open seat on the U.S. Supreme Court late tomorrow. And we want to check in with one of the groups weighing in on who should replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We've reached Marjorie Dannenfelser. She's the president of the Susan B. Anthony List, one of the most powerful anti-abortion rights groups in the country. She joins us on Skype. Welcome, Marjorie.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Marjorie, Roe versus Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court decision that effectively legalized abortion nationwide with some restrictions, to what extent do you see the vacancy in the Supreme Court as a chance to overturn Roe versus Wade?
Well, I don't ever want to prejudge a judge. That's their job, of course. However, it is my great wish and hope that Roe versus Wade is overturned, or at least eroded to the extent that states are allowed to start passing laws that reflect the will of the people of those states.
So we have heard from the Washington Times that you've been in touch with President Trump about his search for a nominee to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Did you speak with the president?
I did, and I've worked with the White House for many months on what a list should look like if there were any additions to it. And that list is incredibly important. I'm not going to be coy. My favorite is Amy Coney Barrett, and has been since she wasn't picked last time. She is the ultimate expression of what my group does, which is advance women like Amy into political positions. In this case, it's not a political position. It's a judge. But she is the ultimate expression of that. And since the cause of our organization is to end abortion, we can't do it without her or somebody like her.
I think you just hit on a point right there that a lot of people are concerned by, and that is whether or not this will be a political position more than a judicial one. Amy Coney Barrett is said to be high on the president's short list. She is a judge, a little bit of background, a judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. She would be the sixth Catholic justice on the court. Whether or not that influences her decisions on the court is in question. How do you think her views represent the views of the country? And does that matter?
I think what matters is her fealty to the Constitution and whether she has a backbone to follow through when she's confronted with cases that test the Constitution. That is the most important thing. I think who she is as a human being is going to really come through in these hearings. And a lot of the difficulties that people are wrestling over now are going to not feel acute at all, because who she is a person who is generous with herself and her life, is expansive in her gifts to others, including two Haitian orphans that she and her husband adopted. She has a Down syndrome child. She has an incredible story about what she's decided to do with her life and how she's mentored students at Notre Dame. I think that her views are in complete sync with those in the United States who are concerned about the preservation of the Constitution and who are really hoping that we have a justice who will honor it.
Well, those things that you mentioned about her personal life are, I think many people would say, very admirable. But specifically, what does that have to do with her ability to be a justice who would, if you think it matters, represent the views of the country, especially on Roe versus Wade? Because we should say polling has shown that the majority of Americans favor upholding Roe and keeping abortion legal in the U.S., even though there's a lot of debate over what kinds of restrictions should be in place.
Well, since she's not a politician, she doesn't have to reflect the overall views of the country on individual policy matters. That's really not her job. That's the Congress's job. That's the president's job and legislature's job. Her job is to interpret the Constitution. So the only thing that matters is that she has a fealty to that. And that is her one job, is to make sure that laws align with that.
Is it true that at one point you supported a woman's right to choose?
Very much. Yes, I did.
And so does that fact, I wonder what changed your mind and whether or not the fact that you changed your view on this, and apparently President Trump, from what we know, has changed his view on abortion, make you realize what a difficult decision this is? And how does that inform your position now and the fate of Roe versus Wade?
Yeah, I feel I do completely understand the mindset of someone who really believes that they are in need of an abortion. That has helped me in my work. What changed my mind was an analysis and really looking and thinking deeply and talking to others about what is the goal of an abortion, what is done specifically, and how do you see this? Do you see this as two people or one person? If you get to the point where you're seeing this as two people's lives at stake, then you do every single thing you can to preserve the lives of both. And that's when my mind changed. I dedicated my life to preserving the lives of both.
There are many progressive groups that have been inundated with donations after the death of Justice Ginsburg. If Republicans are able to get a justice on the court right now of their choosing, does that risk setting them back in some key Senate races or in the presidential election?
No, I don't think so. Whether we like it or not, who this next nominee is and who this next judge is will be a part of what people are voting on, whether they like that person or they don't. And I think it's going to strengthen the hand of the Trump-Pence ticket, because I think any of the choices, and certainly Amy Coney Barrett, will strengthen that appeal to any voter, especially in Rust Belt states that are really where this election is going to be won or lost, like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, and those states there.
Marjorie Dannenfelser is president of the Susan B. Anthony List, which opposes abortion rights. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
It's great talking to you, Lisa.
A federal court has ordered the counting for the 2020 census to be extended through October 31st. That adds another month to the process of collecting responses. The Trump administration is expected to appeal the ruling. NPR national correspondent Hansi Lo Wong has been following the census story. Hi, Hansi.
Hi, Lisa.
What does this nationwide court order by a U.S. district judge in California actually do?
Well, this is a preliminary injunction by U.S. District Judge Lucy Koh, and it orders the Census Bureau to keep up its counting efforts through the end of October rather than ending next week on September 30th, which was the Trump administration's latest plan. And that means, for now, in areas that have not been fully counted yet for the census, door knockers are supposed to keep trying to interview households in person, and the Bureau is supposed to keep collecting responses online at my2020census.gov, over the phone through a toll-free number, or by mail through October 31st.
And so what could happen if the Trump administration appeals the order?
You know, if the administration appeals this ruling either to the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals or maybe even an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court, that could make this messy census even more of a mess. The administration made this last-minute change back in July that it wanted to speed up the census. Originally, you know, it was the administration's idea to push for this extended counting time that the administration originally wanted to end counting on October 31st, that extra month of counting, and then apparently changed its mind in July. I broke the story that door knocking was going to end early, and then days later, the administration announced formally that all counting would end a month earlier than expected. And there's been so much mixed messaging here to the public, and this is partly why Judge Koh issued this order, because she wrote that it was harming outreach efforts by community groups trying to make sure people know exactly how much time they have to get counted if they haven't gotten counted yet. And this all could really hurt the chances of getting a complete and accurate count as the Constitution requires every 10 years.
Hansi, could you unpack that a little bit more for us? Because it seems like it has been a constant back and forth on the census, even since April, when it was first extended because of the pandemic.
Yeah, this is very confusing. I've been dragging for months, and sometimes it's hard for me to wrap my head around it. But I think the thing to remember is that in April, you know, a month after the coronavirus pandemic was declared a national emergency by President Trump himself said at a press conference at the White House, in the White House press briefing room, that this was an act of God, a situation that has to be. The census needed more time because the pandemic had delayed multiple census operations, and that the administration at that time was asking Congress to push back legal deadlines for reporting census results. The first set of results are currently due to the president from the Census Bureau via the Commerce Secretary, who oversees the Bureau, due to the president by the end of this year. These are the latest state population counts used for determining the distribution of seats in the House of Representatives, those 435 seats, how the share that each state gets. It's determined by this first set of results. And top career officials, however, said as early as May that they can't meet this deadline because of the delays caused by COVID-19. And since then, lawmakers have been introducing bills to extend those reporting deadlines. So far, no new laws have passed. But for some reason, the Trump administration in July decided to stop advocating for Congress to change these reporting deadlines. And instead, the administration started putting pressure on the Census Bureau to speed things up against the recommendations of career civil servants at the Census Bureau, who warned that there would be fatal data problems from speeding up the census schedule. It could lead to an unacceptable count and perceptions of politically manipulated results.
Well, what's the rationale the administration is using for wanting to end the census count early?
Justice Department attorneys have said through this lawsuit that their position at this point is the Census Bureau has to meet this legal deadline of December 31st for the first set of census results to the president. That's the law in the books. But Judge Lucy Koh in California, who issued this preliminary injunction last night, wrote in the order that she believes that argument does not hold water. In the 1800s, there were times when census results were delivered after legal deadlines, and Congress, after the fact, extended those deadlines. And also, career officials have said publicly and in internal emails that meeting that deadline is just no longer possible because of COVID-19. There's one email that came out just this week from a top official saying that, quote, any thinking person who would believe we can deliver apportionment by December 31st, those first set of numbers to the president, quote, has either a mental deficiency or political motivation. That's a top civil servant at the Census Bureau.
Thank you, Hansi Lo Wong, NPR national correspondent, joining us from New York. Thanks a lot, Hansi.
You're welcome, Lisa.
This week, we're taking part in a global journalism collaboration of more than 400 news outlets called Covering Climate Now. And for our next story, we go to Georgia. As sea levels rise and hurricanes menace the country's coasts, Georgia is celebrating 50th anniversary of a landmark law that protects its shores. As Molly Samuel from member station WABE reports, the law was part of an effort to preserve an iconic state landscape, the salt marsh.
Georgia doesn't have a very big coastline, only about 100 miles. But the coast it does have is lined by salt marsh, a muddy expanse of tall grass and meandering creeks between the mainland and the state's barrier islands.
I don't know that anybody could look out across the Georgia salt marsh and not be filled with ecstasy.
Georgia writer Janice Ray, on the edge of the marsh, says there's something about the scene that's mysterious and vast. It looks still, but down in the marsh, it's filled with life. Fiddler crabs, oysters, and birds.
The things that you eat, you know, the fish, the shrimp, you know, a way of life.
I don't think anything will survive without the marsh.
Ernest McIntosh Sr. is a commercial fisherman and oyster farmer.
I mean, we have to have it. You can imagine no marsh? No, they wouldn't be right.
The marsh's value and its beauty might be taken for granted now, but in the late 60s, there was a proposal to mine Georgia's salt marsh, to dig it up, then fill it in. The fight that followed eventually led to the passage of the Coastal Marshlands Protection Act in 1970. It was a progressive law for its time, though other states now have marsh protections too. Still, Georgia, with its relatively small coastline, has about a third of all the salt marsh on the East Coast, close to 400,000 acres. And all that marsh is helping Georgia adapt as the sea level rises.
It's very incremental. It's very slow.
Jill Andrews is with the state's Coastal Resources Division.
We'll get these calls of somebody calling and saying, I just don't understand why I have all these fiddler crab burrows in my vegetable garden, or they weren't there before. You know, we hear that again and again. It wasn't there before.
She says it's not only marsh animals like fiddler crabs. People also see salt marsh plants moving into their yards. Sometimes it's more acute, like during the highest tides of the year. Megan DeRosiers is the executive director of the Georgia Environmental Group 100 Miles.
You can't cross roads. Sometimes you can't even go outside.
She says one time the tide got so high it affected her commute.
I had to walk through water. I'd take off my shoes, hike my pants up, and walk through water just to get to my office door. And it was a sunny day.
In Georgia, climate change is causing sea levels to rise by about 3 millimeters a year, which may not sound like much, but it adds up.
3 millimeters per year is about a foot per century.
Clark Alexander is a coastal geologist at the University of Georgia.
We have data for the last 80 years. It shows us that sea levels have been steadily increasing.
By about 10 inches so far, and they'll continue to do so, and likely at a faster rate in the future. And Georgia's marshes, they can move too.
Our marshes are able to migrate into the uplands.
And the 50-year-old Georgia law that protects the marshes follows them. The way the law works, you can't develop or fill in or drain the marsh without a permit. For those permits, you need to first figure out where the marsh is. And one way the state does that is by checking for certain marsh plants. Wherever they are is considered marsh. Jill Andrews with the Coastal Resources Division.
So to that extent, the Marsh Act can be responsive.
Basically, as sea levels move, the salt marsh moves, and the law moves too. But this isn't just about the salt marsh being protected, because the marsh itself buffers Georgia from sea level rise.
So the marshes play a very important role in protecting what's on the upland here in Georgia, particularly right along the edge of where the water and the land meet.
Clark Alexander with UGA says the marshes slow down water that might otherwise flood into dry areas. They also absorb waves. Without the marsh, powerful waves from storms would slam right into the land and erode it away.
As opposed to nowadays, where we see a lot of that wave energy being absorbed by the marsh grasses, just waving back and forth and knocking the wave energy down before it reaches our shorelines.
Georgia is working on ways to adapt to and prepare for increasingly high tides, asking local governments to plan for sea level rise and protecting open space so that the marshes can keep moving inland. But Megan DeRosiers with 100 Miles says there will come a time when the marshes and the 50-year-old law that protects them come so high up that they clash with private property.
So the question is, if the marsh moves inland, what happens to the boundaries of the marsh and what happens to the boundaries of private property? I think we're still trying to figure all that out.
But she says Georgia is in better shape than a lot of other states when it comes to sea level rise, because it's already protected so much land on the coast, and it's protected its marsh. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Samuel in Brunswick, Georgia.
Stocks are higher today, but Wall Street is still heading toward a fourth straight week of losses. And with the economic recovery still very uncertain, House Democrats have agreed to restart talks with the White House on a new coronavirus relief package. A vote could come as soon as next week. Let's take a look at business with MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Ali, welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for being with me. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. And why don't we touch on the stock market just briefly? The S&P 500 on track for its fourth consecutive down week. I guess a lot of people would say, well, the economy's terrible. This should be happening. But what's driving the slump?
Well, what's unusual is how strong the stock market has been throughout the rest of this recession, right? It had recovered almost all of its losses and more from coronavirus a few months in, largely because we've had zero interest rates and companies have been able to borrow as much money as they have been. And if not for what you just talked about, the idea that the Democrats are talking about resurrecting a relief bill, you probably wouldn't even see the slight recovery we're seeing this morning. But even if the stock market spends the next few hours building more than it has, as you said, we're still probably destined for another week of lower closing. That's four in a row.
So I know this is not a normal year, but historically, September is often the worst month for investing. Why is that?
Yeah, so if you go back to about 1950, you see declines on the Dow and on the NASDAQ and on the S&P during the month of September. It's called the September effect. It's worldwide. It's got no particular basis in news or market events. There are theories that investors are returning back to work from summer vacation. They get out of certain positions. They're paying more attention to their stocks. That increases selling pressure. Mutual funds, some of them have their fiscal year end in September. A lot of them don't anymore. So there's no particular reason for it, but it does tend to happen. I would say this is just a weird year, so it's hard to compare it to past years, but that is a trend.
No doubt. There's also an election coming up. Does that have anything to do with it?
Yeah, part of it's the election, and there's always some uncertainty around an election. What tends to happen is sometimes when Democrats win or look like they're going to win, markets sort of get a little softer, but then typically do well under Democratic administrations. In this particular case, there's a combination of the election and the relief package that's coming in or may come in to help with COVID. And a lot of uncertainty. So there's a lot in the mix right now for investors to be thinking about.
Okay, and let's spend a minute on that relief package. Where are we on that and what's in it?
Well, it looks like it's the Democrats are going to suggest a $2.4 trillion package. It will include more stimulus checks, rental assistance, aid for airlines, which is about to expire, more money for small businesses and cities and states. as well as some more money for election security and the U.S. Postal Service. Republicans are not keen on this at all. In fact, Secretary Mnuchin said, we don't need another big package. Others in the administration have said we're in the middle of a recovery, which economists don't seem to think is true. So there's a chance that Democrats may vote on it and pass it in the House and sort of leave it for the Senate to decide whether it wants to pass it. And the Senate either will or will come out with something a lot smaller.
Deja vu, right? And any chance before the election?
It depends. The president does seem to react a lot to these market downturns. So after 4 weeks of lower markets, the president might get on the phone with Mitch McConnell and say, let's pass something.
All right. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thank you as always. Good to speak with you.
Thanks, Peter.
This month marks the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. The United States and the Allies fought the war on two fronts, in Europe against the Germans and in the Pacific against the Japanese. The U.S. and Allied forces won on both fronts. Our next guest says victory over both enemies was never preordained. John Arquilla is a distinguished professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. His newest book is called Why the Axis Lost, An Analysis of Strategic Failures. John Arquilla, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Lisa.
Let's start off with the overall abilities, military and industrial, of the two countries, Japan and the United States, when Japan provoked the war, when it attacked Pearl Harbor. This is December of 1941. What was the strength of these two countries?
In the most important area, which was air power in the Pacific, the Japanese had more than twice the number of aircraft carriers and pilots than the United States. Of course, the United States had much greater industrial capacity and ended up building more than 100 new aircraft carriers before the war was over. But Japanese conquests in the Far East and Pacific Islands gave it access to great oil and other resources that really leveled the playing field. And so it became truly a challenge of who had the better designs for war.
And I know that looking at designs is one of the things that you specialize in. And as part of that, I'd like you to talk about the Zero fighter planes. They eventually became the kamikaze planes that Japanese pilots would use as they took their lives against Allied targets. But these were made by Mitsubishi for Japan. They were monoplanes. They had a single set of wings and a single seat. Early in the war, they could outmaneuver any airplane they encountered. You said they were good, but not that good. Why not?
Well, the Zero fighter was the best plane in the world at the outset of the war in terms of speed and maneuverability and range. But the fundamental design flaw was that in order to have those attributes, the plane was unarmored and it didn't even have self-sealing fuel tanks, so it very easily burst into flame. American planes were slower and bulkier, but they could take all sorts of damage and keep on fighting. And so the Japanese really lost air superiority fairly quickly, especially as the Americans began to move beyond the somewhat obsolete Tomahawk fighters to Corsairs and Mustang fighters. And because Americans had better information about when the Japanese were sending their planes and where they were going, both through radar and through code breaking, hacking the Japanese, if you will, the Japanese never had the benefit of surprise after Pearl Harbor, and this hurt them terribly.
Now, you mentioned that in terms of code breaking that we have so much talk about hacking today, but in World War II, Japan was regularly hacked by American code breakers.
When the war started, the Japanese, I guess it wasn't the samurai tradition to pay too much attention to information security. They remained with codes that early computers, the American system was called MAGIC, in the European theater called ULTRA, first high-performance computers, routinely broke these codes. And so we knew what the Japanese were doing, when they were doing it. It allowed us to ambush the Imperial fleet at Midway. And just as importantly, it allowed us to read all of their merchant marine traffic and to get to a point where we could even tell our submarines where the Japanese merchant convoy would be at noontime the next day. So this was an advantage that made a very, very big difference in the war. It did in the European theater as well, but it was absolutely critical against the Japanese.
But if the response time by the Allies was so quick, Why didn't the Japanese catch on?
Their mathematicians felt that there was no way a team of human beings could decode all the different possible options. And so they thought there was simply no way this could be done. They didn't envision the possibility of a machine doing this. And Alan Turing and others and American computer scientists built this first set of high-performance computers that were able to do what human beings simply couldn't. So really, the hacking age begins in the 1940s.
Can you give us some of the maybe lesser-known codes that was broken that tipped off the Allies and really became a turning point in the war?
The best admiral on the Japanese side was Isoroku Yamamoto, and code-breaking actually allowed American intelligence to know when he was going to be on an inspection trip. And even though he had a fighter escort, long-range American fighters, P-38s, were given the exact time and direction of his flight, and they were able to attack him just as his plane was trying to land on the landing strip at a Japanese base. And they managed to kill really the best strategist on the Japanese side. And of course, in Europe, this mattered in terms of warning the Russians about where the Germans were going to be attacking in the summer of 1942 and again in 1943. And there was an elaborate deception process that was used both against the Japanese and the Germans in terms of feeding them information. Once you're inside someone's own information system, you can use all kinds of techniques to befuddle them. But whether it's in terms of taking out the top Japanese admiral or giving forewarning of where the next Japanese or German move was going to be, these were the things that really won the war. It was the first war won by information alone. You know, they had to fight in the field, but without that good information, the Allies, particularly in the early years, would not have stood a chance.
And let's look at the fighting in the field, because the strategies made a tremendous difference in terms of the submarines. The Japanese I-boats, you say, focused on fighting the U.S. Navy warships instead of on the extended, vulnerable merchant shipping lines, communication between Hawaii and Australia, which you say was a huge mistake on the part of the Japanese. And worse, they thought that U.S. subs would focus on warships, too. And they didn't. Instead, they went after Japanese merchant shipping and sank over 90% of it by the last year of the war, which crippled Japan. What was behind the mindset for the U.S. versus what Japan was doing?
The Japanese, who come out of the samurai tradition, felt that every weapon should be used to fight against the other weapons of the enemy. And so the submarine was simply seen as something that could be used in the engagement of fleets. And this, of course, missed the point that a submarine, once detected, is very much on the defensive. It moves much more slowly than surface warships. And while they did sink some American warships, it was really very few. The Americans, on the other hand, have had a long tradition of raiding commerce of their enemies from the War of 1812 or John Paul Jones going back to the Revolution. So it was a natural thing for our submarines to go after Japanese commerce. And the Japanese didn't even create an organization for dealing with merchant ship safety until November of 1943, nearly 2 years after Pearl Harbor. So that's why you have this tremendous loss of merchant ships. And remember, Japan has so few natural resources. They needed this overseas shipping, and they were virtually crippled on the edge of surrender. Truly, as most senior American military leaders, including Dwight Eisenhower and Admiral Nimitz and Admiral Leahy and others, felt, there was no need to drop a nuclear bomb on Japan. They were already on the verge of surrender, and the emperor was pressuring his own military people to accede to his wish for surrender.
John, I just have one more question about this. Your thesis in the book is that the Japanese defeat and the German defeat, in fact, they were anything but inevitable. But it sounds like the U.S. and the Allies did not win in a rout, but by breaking codes, figuring out strategic wins, such as sinking the merchant ships instead of the Japanese warships, and creating, for instance, sturdier warplanes than what Mitsubishi was creating for the Japanese. Isn't that just how a military wins a war, by exploiting the weaknesses of the other side?
Absolutely. This is a war where the material difference between the Allies and the Axis powers made very little difference. It was actually the insight, the grit, the wisdom, and the sheer fighting tenacity of the Allies that finally won. That's far from a foreordained victory. It's about making best use of the few advantages that you do have.
John Arquilla of the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. His book is called Why the Axis Lost, An Analysis of Strategic Failures. John Arquilla, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa.
The Washington Post reported this week that the CIA believes Vladimir Putin is likely directing a misinformation campaign from Russia to damage Joe Biden's presidential campaign. Yet another reminder that foreign election interference is just as relevant in 2020 as it was in 2016. And it's a problem that local election officials say they need help with. So let's bring in Jared Deering. He's head of Kentucky's Board of Elections in Frankfort. And Jared, you told the state legislature earlier this year that Kentucky's election system is routinely scanned by Venezuela, North Korea, and Russia. What did you mean by that?
What I actually said to the legislature when we were speaking is that we're routinely scanned from IP ranges located within those geographical boundaries. We know that individuals scanning our systems from those areas are they're not up to the good intentions, let's just say that.
Yeah, and when you say scan, what does that mean?
So a scan is a very non-invasive tool that people use to determine whether or not there's open ports or open systems that they can access remotely.
Hmm. And do you have any evidence that they've gotten in or what their intentions would be if they did?
Obviously I can't ascribe intentions to someone that, I don't know ultimately what it is. But no, they have not gotten in. But pre-pandemic culture, election security was at the forefront of a lot of the work that we were doing. And just because we're in a pandemic doesn't mean that stops.
Sure. And this is not 2016. It's not even 2018. You're talking about this is happening now. What kind of resources have you gotten to fight these attempts at intrusion? Because obviously this has been something that, we've been paying a lot more attention to since the last couple of elections.
One of the things that we've done is we try to, I think in the interview that you were speaking about to my legislature, that was actually me lobbying for funding. But we receive both state funding as well as federal funding. But I think it's also important for people to understand that the resources we're given, they are for the entirety of our election system. It's not just for security. It's for, paying for staff. It's for buying ballot faces and envelopes and all the kind of normal processes you have for an election.
We see that Kentucky got $6 million from Congress through the CARES Act for security improvements and election improvements. That doesn't sound like very much. Do you have enough money?
So here's what I would say to that is that, my feeling is that elections funding should always be seen as a tripod of funding. It's a stable system. A stable system of election funding should result in the stakeholders being the federal government, the state government, and local government. But it's really important to understand that these tranches of funding that they kind of drop in with a parachute from the federal government, I think it would be more effective if they were spent out on a yearly budget cycle, because states could more effectively plan for what that budget would look like year to year.
On a different issue, a lot of states around the country are having a tough time finding enough poll workers because of the pandemic. Is that an issue in Kentucky?
It is. And I think it's important to understand, to look at that. How does that system work before the pandemic? And the average age of a poll worker in Kentucky pre-pandemic was 65 years old. When the pandemic hit, obviously now you've got a very large population of your poll workers who fall into that higher risk category. And so we're seeing a lot of our poll workers and a lot of our county clerks not being able to effectively recruit poll workers. I think one of the bigger problems that, we're not really talking about, I think everyone kind of thinks, about elections as being one event on election day, and it kind of just all comes together. When they're in reality, there's months and months of administrative work that goes into making a successful election. Part of that is recruiting poll workers and training poll workers. And to me, that's one of the concerns that I have moving forward in the system is, when you replace one of four poll workers at a precinct location, that's okay, because you can train that one person. They'll norm to the overall behavior of the other three, over the course of the day. But if you replace three of the four, you know, that becomes an incredibly difficult situation. There's a lot of training and a lot of knowledge that goes into running an election at a precinct level. We're really dependent on our poll workers and really dependent on really good poll workers that make sure that elections are running smoothly at the precinct level.
And what you're talking about is just one of the reasons why there's so much anxiety this election. People wondering if there's going to be long lines at the polls. Will their ballots get delivered on time? Are foreign countries interfering with the election? So just level with me as someone who's involved with this so closely. How worried are you about Election Day as we get closer to November 3rd?
Listen, I would tell you in any election, there's always a level of stress and worry that I have, but that's because that's supposed to be my job. But as an elections administrator, as the elections administrator for Kentucky, that I am incredibly confident about our ability to pull off a successful election. One of the things that Kentucky has done extremely well is that we have worked in an incredibly bipartisan manner. We have a Democratic governor, a Republican secretary of state, and that's given us a lot of ability and springboard to implement successful strategies of having a secure and safe election. And so I'm really actually optimistic about our process and how we're going to move forward towards Election Day itself.
Jared Deering, Executive Director of Kentucky's Board of Elections. You're going to be busy in the next couple of weeks, so thanks for making the time to speak with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.